and conflict management. Has long experience in the academy and as a consultant for the UN, the United Nations Foundation, the World Bank, National Intelligence Council, Department of State, Carter Center, USAID, and lots of other places. We unfortunately do not have copies of Professor Ohanian's book with us for sale, but we encourage you to go online and buy it at your favorite independent bookstore. We'll have about 30 to 45 minutes of presentation, and then we'll open the floor up for discussion. We're being recorded, so we're on the record. I would just ask everybody who has phones or other noise-making devices to please do something with them so that they're not making noise. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to Professor Ohanian.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jeff, and a big thanks to CSIS for the opportunity, and to you all for coming out on a Friday afternoon. And in the spirit of a Friday afternoon, I've decided not to subject you to PowerPoint slides, and I'll try to keep this as light and breezy as the topic allows. I'm really excited to be presenting this project to you, this book project, which is an edited volume. And the purpose here is to introduce a new perspective, regional fracture theory, to the study of Russia's foreign policies in post-communist Eurasia and the Middle East. I will also try, if time allows, present empirical applications of the theory in Russia's conflict beltway from Donbas to Damascus. The idea for this book, though, I have to highlight, came when I was working on my previous book on regional integration. As I was working essentially in going to conflict regions, Balkans and South Caucasus, primarily driven to understand whether conflicts are the primary hurdle, objective, primary obstacle preventing fuller regional integration in conflict areas. That was the predominant narrative in the field at the time. So as I was looking at this question and very quickly established that conflicts are not the primary obstacles against regional integration in conflict areas, but my respondents also started to point out that something else is happening, meaning that regional integration is not a consequence of unresolved conflict, but there are very deliberate processes of fracturing, of existing, undoing of existing contacts, connections between communities, states. So I started thinking about this in a more systematic way after completing the first book. I did realize that we know a lot more about the benefits of regional integration, but that we know very little about the cost of missing links. Problems of unrealized regional integration are indeed often seen as dominant, in the dominant scholarship, as extensions of armed conflict. The theory of regional fracture approach argues that it's often the other way around. While my previous book has shown that conflicts are not the primary impediment to regional integration, this book goes further and states that the fractured nature of region often creates a new conflict and consolidates an ongoing one. So I draw from years of fieldwork in South Caucasus, the Balkans, Russia, with over 100 respondents, with business leaders, large and small, diplomats, governmental officials, and a wonderful team of area experts who have applied this theory to Russia's conflict regions, from Ukraine to Middle East. So the argument in this volume is why and how does Russia practice regional fracture? What strategic benefits does it accrue, if any? And whether other hegemonic players practice this strategy as well? We argue that Russia does employ regional fracture as a strategy to keep states in its periphery weak and in its orbit. It also follows from the book that the level of regional maturity in Russia's vast vicinities is an important determinant of Russian foreign policy in the emerging multipolar world order. Importantly, we do present an understudied narrative, which is the agency of these peripheral regions in perpetuating regional fracture from inside. So we argue that Russia does practice regional fracture as a foreign policy strategy, but that regional fracture is not Russian and it's not new. comparative studies with other hegemonic powers at some point are needed to understand how other hegemonic players practice this, if at all. Our book touched on it only marginally, primarily in the Middle East chapter. The main policy message from the book is that we need to learn to build regions that strengthen, develop, democratize states while enhancing structures of global governance from bottom up. And second, understanding the key features of fracture in a given region illuminates the specific mechanisms of Russian involvement and helps to assess Russia's foreign policy in these neighborhoods more effectively. Let me say a few words about the chapter authors and how each one of them are structured. So after I started thinking and studying, delineating the key attributes of regional fracture, I realized that I lacked the deep regional expertise in Central Asia, for example, or Middle East. So I thought that the best route to push this program, this project forward, would be to work with area experts. And I'm really thrilled that I opted for the edited volume option. Robert Nalbandov wrote a chapter on Russia, and he's also the author of Note by Bread Alone, which is a very extensive review of Russian foreign policy under President Putin. Dmitar Bechev wrote a chapter on Balkans. Vsevolod Samokhvalov authored a chapter on Ukraine. Richard Giragosian wrote a chapter on Armenia. Lawrence Browers of Chatham House wrote the chapter on South Caucasus. David Lewis of University of Exeter wrote the chapter on the Central Asia. And Mark Katz of George Mason University down the road wrote the chapter on the Middle East. So regional fracture in big strokes. What is this concept? What do we mean by it? So the core of this book is about regional ties between neighboring states and communities, and the forces and mechanisms driving their disruption. Why is this important? From Brexit to border walls, at this moment of strong backlash against globalization, efforts to recalibrate and adjust neighboring ties have become prevalent in the advanced industrialized West. But for the rest, particularly in post-communist Eurasia, the stakes are higher in some respects. Fractured regions can become global security threats. They consolidate ongoing conflicts, undermine state capacities, and contribute to democratic declines. And why Russia? With the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia's regional peripheries are in the process of rewiring, and much of the scholarship on Russia has assumed that Russia, or a competing global hegemon, is in the driver's seat in shaping that process. While we recognize the centrality of Russia in driving this process, we also point to the role and agency of these peripheries and shattered neighborhoods themselves. Essentially, these fractured regions are contested areas. And when it comes to contested areas around Russia or elsewhere, a range of concepts are used to analyze them. Imperial backyards, spheres of influence near abroad, Truman Doctrine, wedging, shutter belts, and divide and conquer. This is only some of the terminology used to describe geographic areas contested by great power competition. And they all share single attribute. They're all concepts developed from the vantage point, strategic interest of great powers and hegemonic states at various times. And this conceptual bias towards greater powers, has obscured more than the revealed, we argue in this book. It left the regional fabric of peripheries unexamined, be it within imperial systems or in the contemporary spheres of influence by hegemons, big or small. Conceptual biases lead to problematic policy recommendations. These areas are assumed to have little agency in world politics, often viewed as extensions of great power, competition, and interest projections. All of these concepts treat these regions as objects of analysis, devoid of their own agency. We know very little how these regions form and function, how they sustain as coherent units despite their dysfunctionality, what impact do they have on statecraft in these regions, how do they condition, help, or inhibit great power behavior. We know little how they are levers for great power or for great powers as well as liabilities. How do they nourish unresolved conflicts or create new ones, or both? The central policy message from the book, again, fractured regions are threats for global security. They can be both tactical levers or hegemonic powers, which can turn into structural liabilities for them in the long run. So my 7-year-old daughter specifically asked me not to use too many big words. I have to define my concepts. I'm going to break my promise. Regional fracture at its core, we argue, is a modern form of a divide and conquer policy. It's a historically rooted practice of imperial control. And as many historians have shown, imperial centers would engage in so-called heterogeneous contracting, making varied bargains with different ethnic groups, thereby creating divisions and wedges between them to prevent them from coalescing to push against the imperial core. In governing vast multi-ethnic territories, that strategy was used to compensate for the administrative weaknesses of the imperial cores. This was practiced in the Ottoman Empire, Russian Empire, and Soviet Union, to name a few. So how and where is this practiced? Regional fracture is a set of policies. It is confined to specific geographic area among territorially proximate states. It is multilateral, involving more than two entities, states, and non-state actors. It is multi-level, as it can be applied at the level of interstate as well as grassroots societal levels. It is significantly more institutionalized and formalized through regional organizations in the sphere of economy or security. Fractured regions are geographic areas where political, institutional, and social ties are patchy and sporadic, but they do exist. And often they pull in different directions. Such regions emerge in weak state neighborhoods, vulnerable to external interventions, with limited prospects for regional collective action. Fractured regions can be historically conditioned, resulting from imperial legacies. We call this fracture by default. And they can also be deliberate disruptions of region-wide connections, and this is fracture by design. And who engages in this? Actors of regional fracture are those which capture regional processes for narrow ends. These include, but it's not limited to, local oligarchs, national elites, often illegitimate ones, or governments of external hegemons. So what does this approach add to Russia debates? The scholarship and policy analysis on Russian foreign policy is rich and vibrant indeed. But several key explanations can be grouped into several key trends and themes. Perhaps most familiar debate is around the question of who lost Russia. Here the focus has been on the relationship between Russia and the West. And the armed conflicts around Russia's underbelly have been reduced to this prism of geopolitical competition between them, both in analyzing or devising peace processes in addressing them. Some analysts have argued that the US lost Russia because of NATO expansion and the failure to offer Russia a new security bargain in Europe. This approach assumes that things between Russia and the US could have turned out differently after the Soviet collapse. Others, more structural and deterministic in their approach, have insisted that Russia's imperial nationalism and historical preference of large administrative statehood were set to drive Russia into geopolitical competition with the West. History's destiny in this approach. And the individual levels of analysis have focused on President Putin and his leadership style. Another group focused on Russia's domestic politics and economic challenges, issues of regime survival as a variable. Elias Goetz published a very good review on this in the International Studies Review from 2017, if you'd like to explore that further. What is missing from these storylines, from this narrative, is the regional dimension of where Russia is active, the theaters where Russia is active, the missing agency of the peripheries in these fractured regions. And I will elaborate a little bit later as to how theoretically, as well as in policy terms, that is complicated, that is not sufficient in getting Russia right or coming up with policies that calibrate in assessing Russia's role effectively. Some of the mechanisms of fracture, military interventions, cutting off energy supplies to neighboring states practiced by Russia, interference in domestic politics of neighboring states, deliberate rerouting of transportation and energy infrastructures practiced by others in these regions. So the list can go on and on. So the policy rationale for the regions, for the regions in terms of the security cost of the missing links, that fractured regions fueled armed conflicts, undermine diplomatic practices, they make the region vulnerable to geopolitical rivalries, they produce economic protectionism and reward oligarchs, and they weaken stakeholders for cooperation and stability. Policy implications for hegemons. The policies following, implications following from these theories that I've covered, the dominant scholarship on Russia, has been that geopolitical concord of some sort between great powers will trickle down into peripheral peace, that it can pool conflicting parties into mega-regional projects and will result in stability, and regardless of the quality of the peace on the ground. Very often, Russia's role in armed conflict is overestimated or underestimated, armed conflict as well as peace processes. Not understanding the way fractured regions come about and sustain themselves leads to vicious cycles of insecurity and recurrent violence. So the existing approaches that I've covered, they tend to be deductive rather than inductive. So they're grand theories that are applied into specific regions without looking at the empirical realities to develop theories ground up. They offer dyadic measures of international influence, which many scholars have shown to be inadequate in a world of networked states. They also rest on assumptions of clear divisions between domestic and international spheres of politics. And regional fracture theory shows and is based on this statement that foreign and domestic politics are deeply intertwined. They're top-down, and they view the smaller states and peripheral regions as mere extensions of great power competition. And they're very Russia-focused. They do not consider the small state agency, and that area is understudied. Again, trickle-down politics is prioritized. Geopolitical stability is taken as a condition of conflict resolution. So regional fracture approach argues in Getting Russia Right debate that Russian foreign policy is shaped and influenced by the political and economic opportunities existing within the peripheral regions that it has. That Russian foreign policy has been geared towards reducing and limiting regional alternatives for smaller states. And that in the contemporary world, fractured regions offer political, institutional, social, and territorial openings for Russia's intrusion. But that this would vary from region to region, from context to context. In parallel, this fractured region state, fractured state of these regions also weakens and sabotages Russia's full control over these territories. So regional fracture in terms of power, institutions, and values limits as well as emboldens Russia's intrusions in these peripheries. We argue that the quality of regional relationships between neighboring states is consequential, both for their newfound statehoods of the states, as well as for hegemonic powers in their ability to maintain influence over their neighborhoods. Now, the book, the theory chapter of the book identifies power, institutions, and values as three dimensions of regional fracture, but I will not go into the terminology in too much. What I've tried to do for the purposes of this presentation is to simply group them into domestic and international, just to simplify it a little bit. So in terms of the domestic level variables, the higher the levels of state weakness in a given region, the more vulnerable the region is to external fracturing by hegemonic states. And state weakness refers to the levels of public legitimacy of ruling elites, their ability to control violence over their territories, levels of democratization, state building. International variables would include the extent to which a given region is politically settled in terms of dominant regional security orders. Regions lacking region-wide and genuinely functioning institutions offer political wedges, which Russia has been using quite effectively, as it is evidenced in the case of the Western Balkan chapter. How institutionalized are regional orders, how coherent the values that they possess, also determines the openings that Russia can have in some of these regions. The combinations of these two very broad dimensions offers four ideal types, and the cases that we cover roughly fall, represent each of the four types. So a few words about the Balkan chapter, Western Balkan, authored by Dmitry Bechev, by the way, who also just published a book called The Rival Power, Russia in Southeastern Europe. So Dmitry Bechev argues that the Western Balkans is a case of limited political, indirect, localized openings for Russia. He states that this is a story of sliding regional resilience toward greater fracture because of the erosion of stateness in the region, even though it is quite settled in geopolitical terms, with EU remaining the dominant regional order in the Balkans. He also points out that there is an illiberal wave sweeping the region with high levels of corruption, but that these high levels of corruption and illiberalism is tolerated by the European Union for the sake of stability, which he calls stabilocracy. This, he argues, creates arrangements that limit Russia's direct intrusion and offers enough political openings for Russia's sustained intrusion through indirect non-military means. In terms of institutional factors, geopolitical stability, he points out that there is an institutional differentiation between states. Some states are already within the EU, some are not, some are pursuing NATO, others do not. Bosnia is waiting to be promoted for candidacy, and this again creates opportunities for intervention from Russia. Value gap is wide, he argues, because many elites serve lip services on democracy to EU technocrats while doing little to promote such reforms. So he concludes that while Western Balkan is not likely to pivot towards a Russian sphere of privileged interests, Moscow has carved out a niche in the region and is able to leverage it in its strategic interaction with European powers and the United States. We have a chapter on Ukraine. So Ukraine and Armenia are the only two chapters that are representing the application of regional fracture theory at the state level. So this chapter is authored by Vsevolod Samokhvalov, and he published a book called, a few months ago, Russian-European Relations, Great Power Identity and the Idea of Europe. So this is the story that is emerges here is one of state-level application of this approach. That regional fracture here is practiced by external players, Russia and the West, as well as by local elites. And Vsevolod challenges the explanatory power of traditional view that Ukraine faces an East-West dilemma, a geopolitical conundrum in which it has little say. He also challenges Huntingtonian cultural lens used to argue that Ukraine's West is a stronghold of national democracy and Eastern part is inclined towards authoritarian Russia. He rejects external overlay arguments which have been used to cast Ukraine as a battleground between East and West. Instead, he points out the shifting coalitions between national and local elites and their extra-regional patrons in Russia and the EU. His narrative portrays a story of oscillating foreign policies between Euro-Atlantic and Russian orbits, as well as domestic waves of authoritarianism and democracy that create this process. This is a story of weak regimes, shifting coalitions of political elites and charismatic personalities, changing interests of external hegemons. Transient nature of power resources, a key feature of regional fracture theory, is dominant in this case, which has made the country vulnerable to external pressure. Few words on Central Asia chapter, authored by David Lewis of University of Exeter. He does have an article called Geopolitical Imaginaries in Russian Foreign Policy in Europe-Asia Studies. So David argues that there are all kinds of tensions between states in this region over borders, resources, security, combined with deep political and social cleavages within states and geopolitical competition across the wider region. And they make Central Asia as a deeply fractured region. But he also points out, despite all of these fractures, there is a limited regional cooperation at the elite level between governments, as well as external hegemons, because they share a common discourse on illiberal regionalism, he argues, which is at odds with Western notions of regionalism. So relative coherence around illiberal values and norms has enabled cohabitation of China and Russia, he argues, and make it hard for US and the United States to establish presence. Weak regional institutions and are transient and informal power applications are also critical to these weak states. And some of the mechanisms of fracture that he highlights here, exclusionary nation building policies in Uzbekistan that has gotten better, obviously, and Turkmenistan, external hegemonic efforts to blanket the region with their regional models of cooperation by US, Russia, and China, ended up introducing new divisions, new wedges, and undermined capacity and prospects for regional integration. Existing regional organizations, CSTO, for example, are limited and have a very limited reach. Eurasian Economic Union, as a geopolitical, rather technocratic institution, did introduce new tariffs and divisions in the region, again, pulling only some of the countries in. To summarize, this is a region of weak statehood and relative geopolitical stability, which has led to diverse and multiple access points for Russia, institutional and formalized, indirect, and perhaps quite extensive. South Caucasus. So we have a chapter on South Caucasus and chapter on Armenia, authored by Browers. South Caucasus chapter is authored by Lawrence Browers, who does have a book coming out on authoritarian conflict management strategies with University of Edinburgh. And Richard Kiragosyan, who is the director of regional studies in Armenia, a very prolific analyst and writer. So I do invite you to look into their works as well. So this region is a case of weak state and low geopolitical stability, diverse and offering diverse and multiple access points for Russia, direct, institutional, as well as military, which we've seen in 2008. Fracture in terms of power and institutions is explicit, values pulling in different directions, democratic and authoritarian. The book was written before Armenia's Velvet Revolution that did change the regional fabric dramatically, and perhaps we can talk about this during the Q&A. In terms of the mechanisms of fracture that Browers highlights is geopolitical patron-client relationships are present, meaning that Russia does work through the elites within this region. While these power resources have been patchy and sporadic, they did contribute to the high level of fracture in this region. Instrumental bilateralism is another fracture. While Russia does promote its regional institutions, but Browers argues that these multilateral institutions that Russia champions and promotes, they're simply multilateral gloss over bilateral relationships. Russia remains comfortable in building bilateral relations because it's those relationships that give Russia the most control over its relationships. And then he talks about the visibility of secessionist conflicts, de facto states, as front lines of regional fracture. I differ on this point from Lawrence, and we haven't even discussed this, but perhaps we could talk about in Q&A. In the Kiragosyan chapter on Armenia is essentially a study of statecraft practiced in fractured regions. There's so much analysis of complementary foreign policies that smaller states in such fractured regions practice, trying to hedge and balance. And Armenia is a really good case study to the effectiveness of such policies. But the analysis before the Velvet and after Velvet is quite fascinating. And I'll conclude with the few words on the chapter on the Middle East. authored by Mark Katz. He also recently co-authored a big report called the focused on the relationship between Russia and China and the U.S.-Russian relationships, current development and future trends, published by the Finnish Institute of International Affairs. So what is interesting about Middle East is that this has been a historically fractured region from imperial times. And this chapter is perhaps the most historical one in the volume. Katz argues that Russian interventions here, Russia practice or exploits existing regional fracture inherited from the previous imperial practices. Kremlin, he argues, regained influence lost at the end of the Cold War. But at the same time, the fractured state of the region also limits Kremlin to push fully with the policies that it intends. So there's this end of totality, total control, and that is emerging as a storyline in all of the chapters. He highlights, in terms of the institutions, he talks about the internal domestic weaknesses of the states that have, after decolonization, and because the institutions, they did not ever emerge, and challenges of democratization, obviously, with which the region has struggled, pushed the politics into revolutionary phases, and that securitized the context and also created movements for Russian intervention. In terms of values, democracy versus authoritarianism is a schism between governments and the society, Sunni-Shia sectarian split, they are territorially cross-cutting and region-wide. So all of this definitely pull in to create opportunities and wedges for Russia to exploit. So perhaps I'll stop here, and we can perhaps explore some of these threads together.
Okay, great, thank you, and that was extremely comprehensive. I guess let me start with a couple of questions and then we can sort of throw it open to the audience. I'm sort of intrigued with this notion of regional fracture. You know, it sounds like there are, in the book, lots of regions to which the concept can be applied. And I'm curious trying to think of regions of the world that are comprised of relatively small countries that are peripheral to large or post-imperial countries that wouldn't be considered fractured. I mean, maybe Southeast Asia would be one, maybe Latin America, I don't know. But, you know, it seems to me that if you want to take those as examples of non-fractured regions, if you will, one of the things that is different about them is that they're not caught between imperial hegemons or post-imperial hegemons. And so as much as, you know, you're talking about some of the internal drivers within these regions of this fragmentation, you know, it seems the geopolitical context is very important. And I was wondering if you could maybe address sort of the balance between internal and external factors in fragmenting regions. And then maybe from a more practical perspective, what do we do about it? If the objective of peace, democratization, stability, whatever you want to call it, is served by ending or at least ameliorating the consequences of regional fracture, if you're going to go brief this down in Foggy Bottom or, you know, 1600 Pennsylvania, what are your suggestions for how to go about doing that?
Nightmare question for an academic. So it's a very great question, Jeff, in terms of the internal drivers and geopolitical conditions. Absolutely, I mean, geopolitics still does matter, but the reason that we decided to look at all of these regions is precisely that, and we probably should have articulated that better in the book, meaning that regions are fractured differently, and those regions that have low statehood and low geopolitical stability, these are the most fractured regions, and they're going to be most vulnerable to geopolitical competition. So the internal drivers do interact. What we're trying to argue is that the internal drivers do interact with geopolitical forces, and that unless there are internal capacities of cross-regional engagement, unless stakeholders of regional engagement are mobilized, external will be very easy for any hegemonic power to intervene and to capture processes. And in such regions, very often stakeholders, beneficiaries, villages, for example, in the border areas, they're silenced. They don't have a say in peace processes. So at the end of the day, it comes down to the nature of the regional fracture, and the internal drivers do matter in terms of constraining the external forces. And the balance is really the right word. Latin America, indeed, is a South America in particular, has been considered a zone of peace for a long time because for the eliminating pretty much any territorial issues, border issues. Internal high levels of crime definitely are an issue, but overall, this is a region that is considered as a zone of peace. And probably because Latin America has started earlier in with its independence and experimented with forms of regional engagement, and Latin America, as any part of the world, efforts and drivers of building regional connections between countries has been motivated by containing a big brother, right, a big hegemon. In that respect, Latin American experience is really fascinating. Now, looking at what's happening in Venezuela and all the public health crisis, migration, all the non-immediate physical strategic security related issues that are hugely important, looking at how it's important to see how regional resiliency in Latin America will help to address that conflict within the continent. In terms of the balance, regional resiliency is the argument, is the concept that I would introduce here, referring that these regions need to, within the state, lack of legitimacy is problematic, is definitely driving fracture, and diplomatic capacities in building connections within the region. And I'm not talking about full-blown EU-style regional models, building in South Caucasus, for example, but some modicum of regional order is necessary. In terms of policy implications, this is really an important question. Most peace processes in all of these conflict regions are top-down, elite-driven. I just finished a piece that should be coming out with Washington Post Monkey Cage on this, focused on Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. So when we look at these regions from the regional integration perspective, Eurocentric, EU model, right? Let's build this, let's solve this conflict so region will flourish. What is emerging from this book is that unless the regional fracture is addressed, conflict resolution will not follow. Meaning that regional orders, a certain level of regional order has to be established from which conflict resolution can follow. Why? Because such an approach creates numerous opportunities of depoliticizing conflict management processes. And this is essentially an experience that Western Balkans has been going through. Some will say the Dayton Accords was problematic, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, there are serious concerns with the Dayton Agreement, but at the end of the day, there is amazing experimentation that has been happening in Western Balkans in depoliticizing conflict management processes, trying to establish some sort of regional order from which conflict resolution on specific conflicts can follow.
So what would that look like between Armenia and Azerbaijan?
I probably will not, this opinion probably will not be, my position will not be very popular either in Armenia, in Azerbaijan, or Nagorno-Karabakh. But there, and after the Velvet Revolution, I don't know how much you follow, there has been a flurry of diplomatic activity between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and President Aliyev, and everybody there. On the one hand, there's this excitement, this is really a new beginning, but there are also peace-building practitioners, also concerned for the region, worry that this is too fast, too soon. My take on this is that there's a lot of scholarship on what makes a good peace agreement. And the existing diplomatic activity remains elite-driven. One thing that is encouraging is that the two sides have demonstrated an ability to talk on their own without mediators, without Russia, for example, right? Even though the peace regime has been functioning under the OSCE Minsk group. So on the one hand, it's encouraging, it's wonderful that they're diplomatic active, but they remain uninstitutionalized. And the existing scholarship does argue that one shot, single shot, big bang peace agreements have a very poor track record of implementing. And because this conflict is nested in this deeply fractured region, inherited from the Soviet years, right? The danger, the possibility of the peace process, ongoing, very fragile peace process being derailed is very high. At any moment, the peace process can be captured either by Russia or by groups that sort of spoilers on both sides in the conflict. An important step is to include Nagorno-Karabakh as a party, to have as many voices present at the negotiating table as possible. This might also include refugees from Nagorno-Karabakh that are in Azerbaijan, also a position not favored on the Armenian side. But essentially, there is some capacity of region-wide peace-building networks and practitioners that are working, but they have been silenced, they have been cut out from the processes. So what this study will say is, let's cultivate those networks. Let's start building some sort of a regional arrangement in order, number one, to manage Russian intrusion, institutionalize Russian intrusion perhaps, or modernize it, make it more, functional, genuinely functional. And number two, such an approach will also help make compromises easier down the road. Right now, requesting compromises on all sides without creating some sort of a dividend would be very difficult.
Okay, let's open it up for questions. We have a microphone in the back, so I'll recognize people. Sarish will give you the microphone. When you get it, please quickly identify yourself, name and affiliation, then ask a question. Don't make a statement, ask a question, something with a question mark at the end, and preferably be brief about it, so.
Good afternoon, thank you. I'm Pyotr. I'm half English and Russian, studying at SAIS. So listening to all this, and I'm hearing a lot of quite interesting, deeper things than I've been studying during my strategic studies. But what I keep coming back to is sort of the end point for Russia. I've got a series of sort of sub questions which all sort of accumulate into one major one, which is basically, what is Russia's grand strategy in all of this? Could you consider that regional fracturization, if I can amend the word like that, is sort of Russia's potential grand strategy to essentially just keep the region in the status quo, destabilize, Putin play mind games, and generally just sort of, you know, get lots of fingers in lots of different pies in each of the ex-Soviet satellite states, just so that they can maintain geopolitical influence and regional hegemony, if that makes sense. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much for the question. Great question. The end point for Russia. So I would argue that yes, the narrative on Russia that emerges from here is that Russia does use these fractured regions as levers. At least that's the intention on the Kremlin side. I have a piece on this specific question, again, in Washington Post, Monkey Cage. If you Google it, you'll find it. But basically, in all of this conflict areas, Russia is either has peacekeeping troops or is part of the peace process in some form or shape, or a conflict member. So Russia does like to be involved because these fractured regions, tactically, there's we need to make a distinction between tactics that Russia is using and a strategy. I think Russia is using the fractured regions tactically, which is unfortunate. Russia is looking at these regions for tomorrow, but is not thinking for day after. By looking at this in a very short term, it does elevate Russia's position globally if hunt for status is what's driving Russia, then being part in these areas, number one, allows to recapture the territories and political influence that it lost, but also to elevate its role as a global player. But regions are also can be opportunities. So the message that emerges for Russia is that any hegemon, any with the great power aspirations, is as strong as its neighborhoods. It is very difficult to project a global prominence if as a global power your neighborhood is really shattered. And here, looking at the institutions that Russia has been building. For Eurasian Economic Union. When I was doing interviews in Russia, many respondents, and I would ask this question quite bluntly, what is Eurasian Economic Union? Is the Soviet Union 2.0? To which the answer would be no, this is not any different from European Union. And they're correct to say that right now, regional organizations are fastest growing in the world. But what is different about Eurasian Economic Union is that Russia is struggling to treat it as a technocratic institution, essentially play by its own rules, allow to rebuild its neighborhoods, which essentially would make a Russia relevant, welcome player and partner in this peripheries. So my answer to this would be that if Russia wants to play the long game, obviously it is tied to Russia's internal domestic developments as well. And if Russia does want to become a regional center in this part of the world, then all of these relationships need to be renegotiated. Right now, these organizations are very Russia-centric. They're one-sided. They are built around Russia's economic and political interests. But if you look at successful regional organizations, for example, there's a lot of distribution of income within the regional bloc between large and small, because small and large states within the regional bloc benefit differently, right? For example, Armenia was pretty much compelled to join Eurasian Economic Union after Armenia has negotiated with Eastern European Partnership Agreement for 4 years, right? And just the act of that massive U-turn indicates that this was really a political process. But Armenia is a small state. And in that respect, small states are much more vulnerable in being part of a big regional group as opposed to a large state. So Russia needs to take the interests of the smaller states very seriously if it wants to play this game in the long term. I hope that answers your question.
Okay. In the back there.
Hi, Kristen Cherrigate with the Caspian Policy Center. So I'm wondering, with the breakdown of the Soviet Union, in your own opinion, because I loved how you kind of took away from some of the authors, you said that you disagreed with maybe a couple of things they had said. In your own opinion, what region or specific states do you think have taken the greatest strides in trying their hardest to move away from being a weak state? And what do these strides look like, as an example, to other countries?
I like how you framed your question, which you did not say pulling away from Russia, because again, I guess what we're trying to do with, at least I do in my scholarship, move the conversation away from east to west. We're not going to change geography, and these countries are where they are. Russia is a large market. It has enormous soft power resources, literature, music, which in my mind, I don't think Russia's using it as much as it should. But in terms of the state weakness is the argument. Looking one region that is not in the chapter is the Baltic region, is the Baltics. So Baltics comes close to what we would call resilient regions in a way that they have made the most progress in statehood, in state strength. They're in terms of closing the gaps between legitimacy between governments and their people, and they're part of the European Union. Now, I'm not advocating that for South Caucasus to be fully resilient, it has to be part of the European Union. And I would argue that's the wrong way to think about this. However, if So I would say my answer would be the Baltics, because this domestic strength in institutions and diplomatic practices helps to increases the ownership of the region, ownership of the state for their region. So I would say the Baltics. I'm more optimistic about the Balkans than Dimitar Bechev is, but he's correct to argue that the Balkans relatively a bit more settled, but it still has openings for Russia.
Okay, over here.
Hi, Pat Span, just a retired Govey. I was in Uzbekistan in Tashkent in 2003, and I was taken aback by the I didn't meet, until I went to Samarkand, I didn't meet any Uzbeks. They, everybody in Tashkent was Russian, ethnic Russians. And my question is, given the percentage in those countries, especially the stands, were Russian for 150 years, people forget that, do the ethnic Russians see themselves as citizens of these new states, or do they see themselves as ethnic Russians? I mean, this is the argument we are seeing in the Baltics. We're seeing, I mean, people forget that Khrushchev gave the Crimea to the Ukraine in the 50s. So that they took it back is no surprise to me. But so I guess my basic question is, do the ethnic Russian, even though they're multiple generations, many generations in these areas, do they see themselves as belonging to those nation states, or do they see themselves as Russians?
Yes, that's a very important question for the following respect. Actually, Russia, as you probably know, has been using this argument in order to justify its privileged state, its sphere of privileged influence around its borders, arguing that there are a large number of Russians living in many countries in Central Asia, obviously, in Ukraine, most vividly. So the argument of Russian world has given the Kremlin permission, or not permission, justified the Kremlin's role that we intend to protect our compatriots, and therefore we're entitled to intervene if they feel threatened. I would also say that this is a question of state weakness. It depends on whether the countries in Russia's peripheries will build states strong enough that are inclusive, that consider the minorities fully. So we can talk all day long how much Russia practice drives regional fracture in these neighborhoods, right? What I argue is that the agency of this state, of these regions, is also important. If this state succeed in integrating minorities, Russian and others, fully, and building administratively strong states, then it makes this state more resilient. It creates stakeholders that will play cross-regionally, and it does close at least political openings for the Kremlin, at least on this regard.
Hi, John Lechner. Thank you very much for your presentation. And I just got back from Moldova, which I think would be the perfect case study as well for maybe a future book or a chapter. One sees it there in Venezuela as well, that Russian foreign policy was also a reflection of individual oligarchic interests. And I'm wondering if your book, you saw in other regions, fractured regions, Russian foreign policy as a reflection of fractured oligarchic interests at home, rather than Russia or Putin as some sort of monolith.
Oligarchic interests in the smaller states, peripheral states?
Oligarchic interests in the smaller states, and a reflection of oligarchic interests back home in Russia influencing policy, rather than simply kind of Russia as one monolith acting kind of individually as kind of Putin.
Yes, the short answer is yes on both sides, meaning that there are oligarchic interests in, within the states in these peripheries as that are working in collaboration and cooperation with oligarchic interests in Russia. I'm trying to remember whether we specifically addressed that point, but I would say that the fact that states in these peripheries, in these regions, there are competitive authoritarian states, meaning that there are authoritarian states, but that allow some openness from in the media, in political parties. Armenia was a typical, was always considered a competitive authoritarian state. But because they were so weak and kind of trapped between democracy and authoritarianism, their governments were always poor legitimacy domestically, so there was they were always searching for external patrons to justify their rule. So this chase for patrons is specifically talked about in a book. We draw from linkage leverage scholarship, Levitsky and Way, and that explains how open porous the states are. So I would say that not specifically on the corruption and oligarchy definitely are their beneficiaries for the regions to remain closed. In South Caucasus as well, unresolved conflicts allow to divide markets. It makes it difficult for a very small entrepreneur to cross the border to buy the leather to make the shoe, because that person cannot do that, has to wait until some big oligarch who has connections and the contacts to the government to go get the leather from the country to bring it here so he can access it. So these issues have very real relevance on the ground, developmental impact. The short answer is yes, linkage leverage is a huge component of regional fracture, and that elites, the governments, the regional fracture is practiced at the level of elites. And specifically, there's a lot of scholarship on the corruption and the oligarchy around the countries, but that's the state, only strong states will be able to address that issue. And corruption is becoming a question of immediate physical security question, right? In the case of the Armenia's Velvet Revolution, it as the same in Azerbaijan, people always would tolerate it because in cases of unresolved conflicts, there is the silent bargain, security versus democracy. It's a false choice, I've argued in my writing, but that's how illegitimate regimes will govern. We cannot democratize right now because we have this unresolved security issue, and corruption thrives in that context. In 2016, short four-day war between Armenia and Azerbaijan exposed the issue of corruption in Armenia, and I do think it played a role in bringing large numbers of people out in the streets during the Velvet Revolution. In Azerbaijan, it's harder. I mean, obviously, it's a petrostate, fully entrenched authoritarian regime. Civil society, so the dynamics there is very different, much harder, unfortunately, in Azerbaijan.
Okay. Sitting down over here on the side.
You. Good afternoon, ma'am. Captain Brian Park, United States Marine Corps. So have you seen in your research a primary means or some sort of pattern the Russians have utilized for fracturing regions such as political instability, meddling, economic policies, cyber attacks, propaganda, etc.?
I think there's a lot of, I'm trying to remember, the issue does come up in many of the chapters. We don't have the book does not have anything specifically on cyber attacks per se, but it does come up in all of the issues. Russian intervention or restraint, I keep picking on Armenia today, but the Russian restraint during the Velvet Revolution has gotten a lot of currency. We did not talk about it in the book, again it was before, but that is an important question as to why Russia fortunately did not intervene in Armenia's Velvet Revolution while it took Ukraine's transitions quite seriously. But the fact that Russia does use media, cyber, I mean, it's really common knowledge, I think. I've did some interviews with media professionals in Russia, and it was fascinating. I mean, some amazing journalists that I interviewed who were quite frustrated, I would point out that contemporary media environment, Russia Today or others, they are not, they're much savvier. They're not the traditional propaganda machine in Soviet years. So it's a lot more savvy, there's a lot more entertainment built in it. But the fact I'm working on another book right now, and one of the chapters tackled that question, arguing that Russia did not use the cyber attacks and trolls that it could have used in the case of Armenia's Velvet Revolution. The short answer is that they're there. The interesting question is, when does Russia choose to use them, when it does not?
Okay, so over here.
Thank you. I'm Marina Fazel, an African-American journalist. If you would please describe how you would characterize Russia's involvement in the peace process in Afghanistan, would you characterize it as motivated by wishing to keep its backyard a peaceful region, or motivated by participating in the great power competition? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question. I have to admit that I have not looked closely, specifically, to Russia's role in Afghanistan. But I have studied the state-building processes in Afghanistan from my first book, in terms of the microfinance and state-building efforts. Overall, let me answer it this way. I think overall, I should look at Afghanistan, actually, Russia's role in Afghanistan. I would say that looking at Russia's role in conflict management capacities in other parts of the world, the tendency in the Kremlin has been more to manage this conflict, not to essentially, one respondent at some point described Russia's role in some of this armed conflict as a thermostat, that Russia can heighten the conflicts or try to manage them. But there is a question between stability and resolution. And this is not only it's a big challenge for Russia, regardless if it's genuine in trying to build Afghanistan and play a proactive role in Afghanistan. After all, strong Afghanistan is in Russia's interest. It's close to Russia, right? Failed state in your backyard is not something that any state would want. But at the same time, I have to say that not many states have a good track record of building conflict management processes that are sustainable. And that at the end of the day, it will come down to the local capacity. Afghans have to take as much as possible, as quickly as possible, the steering role in state building process. Obviously, I realize that that's a huge challenge, but I would not put a lot of emphasis on as to what Russia can do. But at the very least, I think the Afghan government needs to be a lot more, very savvy in dealing with these competing pressures, hegemonic players that are there even for state building purposes.
Okay.
Dan Roper, Association of the United States Army. Could you assess the impact on regional stability on the increased NATO military activity over the last several years, mostly the training and rotational units into the Baltics and Southeast Europe? And what do you think the impact would be if the U.S. military repositioned some of its forces from Germany to Poland? Thank you.
Wow, that's very specific. I'll do my best. I think Dmitry Arbechev would be the right person to provide you full, very detailed answer on this. But my own analysis shows me that the role of NATO in Eastern Europe, and obviously a very big region, I mean, it's more or less succeeded. It obviously stabilized the region, provided the much necessary security blanket for domestic reforms to carry out. But that succeeded because it really went in parallel, hand to hand, with European presence. Now, in other parts of the world, I don't have a good answer for this. Georgia, Ukraine, they have been wanting to join NATO. What NATO expansion tends to do, and I'm finding myself agreeing with President Putin, but not for the reasons that he will state, is that it does activate this competition in the region. And unfortunately, the states in these peripheries, in these regions, do pursue these big regional projects at the expense of their immediate regional ties. So if any NATO expansion was carried out or considered by the states in parallel with states themselves strengthening their own regional cooperation, it perhaps would make NATO's expansion not look like as polarizing as it does right now. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, so over here.
Uh, Mike McFinsky's student. Now, my question is, has your research carried you into a post-Putinism kind of vision of Russia? Let's think Alexei Navalny, and could there be close ties to the EU?
Post-Putin, that's the million-dollar question, right? Everyone is wondering about that. So obviously his term limit is coming up. Many analysts are that I have read do not think that end of Putin is anytime near. The question is, and there's a New York Times actually just published an interesting article on environmental issues, environmental protests over garbage disposal, basically arguing that that there has been a trend. I mean, the strategy, Kremlin strategy of external intervention to divert attention, that definitely has been a scapegoat, right? Scapegoating definitely has been a pattern, but that Putin is losing. His popularity ratings are down from 80 to 60, and a Russian journalist I was interviewing told me that that's for Russia is very low. Any Western politician would have died to have 60% approval ratings, but for Russia, that's really low. So, post-Putin, though, obviously in Yeltsin years, the hopes within the West has been that Russia would integrate, would become a quote-unquote normal state. What does it mean? I guess I would reframe your question to see whether Russia can become a normal state. What does it mean? It obviously, in respect to fractured regions, it would mean that Russia would engage with its former colonies, renegotiate relationships, become an insight. It already has a lot of leverage over them. Instead of pushing it in, become a wanted neighbor. But that depends domestically as to whether Russia can carry out all of the much needed domestic reforms, governance issues. Right now, the pattern, the trend has been to push down reforms top down, high modernism, right, has been used to describe it, but without decentralizing, without the rule of law is an issue. So I guess post-Putin, in terms of the peripheries, I would have liked to see Russia, obviously that is fully democratic, strong civil society, large prosperous markets, and in that case, the neighbors would definitely be driven to that large market. And as for the neighbors, I mean, they should not be forced to choose. They should have the opportunity to be part of several regional blocs. But in the case of Russia, Russia still is perceived as a threat as opposed to as an opportunity. So post-Putin, I was very hopeful about Navalny, and I don't know enough about that, but he's also viewed as being somewhat very nationalistic, kind of inward-looking, xenophobia was used to describe, so I don't know. I'm not sure if I would, I think the question is not about one person. The question is whether civil society can develop in Russia, and it's highly educated population. And if given the opportunity, I mean, if civil society thrived, I think that is really where I think the magic is pretty much.
Okay, do we have any more questions? Okay, right here.
Hi, thank you for a very interesting presentation. Blake Wilcox, I'm an MA candidate at Georgetown University. My question is, can we apply regional fracture theory to Russia itself in addition to the regions that surround it? And to what degree is Russia itself fractured? And what can the application of that theory teach us about Russia or inform us about Russia? Thank you.
I never thought about that. Thank you for the question. I think it can be applied to Russia, absolutely. Primarily, the question becomes whether Kremlin would allow strong local capacities of governance to evolve inside Russia. It's a multi-ethnic state, right? There are various provinces, and much of that is heavily centralized, kind of top-down governance, which in an age of fast-moving economies and globalization, an age of, I don't know, we're going to wake up every day, you have a new generation of a smartphone. That level, that logic of economic globalization does not translate well into top-down governance. So inside Russia, multi-ethnic state, the question, they are fractured, I would say, because they're quite weak in their own in terms of their administrative capacities. While there are not states on their own, as administrative units, the elites remain weak. They remain captured, and everything is linked to the center. And in that respect, there's amazing, unfortunate continuity between contemporary Russia to Soviet Union and Russian Empire. I was born and raised in Soviet Union, and it took me a while to think about Soviet Union as an empire. But what does make Soviet Union an empire, what does make Russian policies imperialistic, not that different from Russian Empire, is that there's no capacity being built or capacities in the peripheries, whether outside Russia or inside Russia, are crushed. So if capacities of self-governance, self-organizing, decentralization are undermined, that's what essentially keeps this regional fabric divided. And as a result, Russia itself weak.
Okay, I see another hand in the back.
Hi, Alex Sanchez, Jane's Defense. I was wondering if you can talk more about Moldova, which is actually going to have elections on Sunday. Are the fractures in that country unsolvable, not just because of Russia's presence, but just the own sins that of the Moldovan government, like stealing $1 billion of its reserves? Can Moldova be safe as a single state, or do you think Transnistria is lost? Maybe Gagauzi may follow suit. Thank you.
Yeah. There's I know about the upcoming elections, and there are some regional watchers of Moldova as well as Russia worry that there are a lot of parties, the popularity of parties that are pro-Russia, that they're ranking, they're actually polling quite high. I would argue that it probably matters less as to who comes to power, but as to whether institutions, elections remain clean. This was one of the lessons from Armenia, actually. As long as the country as a whole participate and validate elections as a process, that will go a long way in strengthening the Moldovan state. In respect to the Transnistria, that is for the people to decide, really, and hopefully again, the conflict management processes need to be structured to see where the economic interests lie, as to whether Transnistria might see value in staying with Moldova, or if Moldova becomes so fully integrated regionally that Transnistria negotiates a deal that can dip into both sides. But in looking at the new scholarship that is emerging on de facto states, as well as policy analysis, they have been advocating for engagement of such de facto states such as Transnistria in a status neutral way. Meaning right now, these de facto states such as Transnistria, they are white dots. They're described as white dots on the map, which can be quite dangerous for everybody. These are ungoverned territories, and also the living standards of people living in such territories goes very down. They don't have they can travel, they can have access to healthcare, et cetera. So at the very least, in a short term, status neutral engagement with such de facto states, including Transnistria, is essential in order to keep them engaged into various areas of economy and social development.
So if I could, I just want to go back to your answer to the questioner's first question, and where you talked about elections and the importance of elections and the acceptance of elections as a legitimate way of resolving questions about the distribution of power is sort of being key to overcoming this fragmentation. And I'd like to then, in that context, raise the question of Ukraine again. Because in 2010, we had a very free and fair, by all accounts, election in Ukraine that led to the victory of Viktor Yanukovych, who, whatever you thought of him, was elected legitimately and was accepted by all sides as being the legitimate president of Ukraine. And yet, throughout his time in power, took steps that if anything, worsened the problem of fragmentation within Ukraine and of Ukraine within the wider region. So I was just curious if that, what that experience tells us about this larger question of the importance of elections, and if it maybe says anything about the way that you answered the question about Transnistria, or about Moldova.
Thank you. That's a great, great question. I would say that, expand on the importance of elections by saying that elections plus engaged, fully mobilized civil society. Overall, studies show that, especially in hybrid regimes, competitive authoritarian regimes, even fraudulent elections, fake it till you make it, those elevate habits of participation, expectations of democratic participation. Those, while elections by themselves are not linked to bringing about democratic societies, but once democratic opening is established, those polities that have participated in elections, even fraudulent ones, are likely to consolidate their democracies. This was an issue that Armenians were grappling with. Election after election, a lot of fraud, and people didn't want to go to vote. So there's all this debate, is it worth going to the cast a ballot? So elections plus civil society, again, elections on their own, do very little. What is interesting about Ukraine, as well as Georgia and the color revolutions, is that they're very big waves, elections, again, are important, but again, strong civil society that is mobilized is essential. So color revolutions, whether in Ukraine or in Georgia, they were perhaps the first generation, earlier generation of democratic transitions in that space, but they tended to be very big wave and top down, and once the autocrat was removed, people thought that we're done, let's go home. And again, studies show that sustained mobilization of the public is what consolidates democracies in the long run. In the case of the Velvet Revolution in Armenia, elections actually, people came out because of electoral issues to protect the institutions, which was really important. And while it is described as a revolution, and Armenians don't like when I say it, but I don't call it a revolution, and it's wonderful that it was not a revolution because it did not challenge the state. It actually wanted to protect the institutions, the flawed constitutional reform that the government had done. So the Velvet Revolution unfolded within that spectrum. But in contrast to color revolutions, Armenian civil society had time to mature. So it had deep capacities that mobilized. This was orchestrated as a non-violent civil disobedience campaign. And they succeeded in keeping galvanizing around an issue of electoral politics, but they succeeded in keeping the public mobilized from April to May, when the final elections, parliamentary elections were done that consolidated and closed the opening.
Okay, Kathy.
Kathy Cosman, to return briefly to the possibility of fractionalization or fracturing of Russia, I think there are several factors that need to be kept in mind. One is the fact that I think educational standards and health standards have declined since the Soviet period. And I think health standards, even Putin, or at least the government, has been forced to admit that yes, they have less money to spend on that. And also, a step that Putin has very actively taken is to say that the study of minority languages in the minority-majority parts of of Russia is now voluntary, which is a big change from the Soviet period.
Yeah. Okay, I guess that was more of a comment. Okay.
Hi, I'm Alka Bhatnagar. Thank you very much for this very enlightening presentation on the book. I'm a retired Foreign Service officer, and I did cover the Balkans and the Caucasus right from 2011 to 13, so I covered the whole regions. What I saw, and very interesting, is this fractured nations and regions. Say if you take the example of Croatia, they probably are very happy and done. Yeah. But what about between Serbia and Kosovo? You have this whole Mitrovica, which is still fractured. Even in the Caucasus, you have the northern part of Georgia, which is still conflict region. So what would be that therapy first to heal those smaller fractures rather than think about those large fractures to heal?
Yeah, great question, thank you. So when I was doing field work in my previous book in the Balkans, and Croatia, I think, was about, when I was doing an interview, it was about to join European Union. Many business entrepreneurs in Bosnia and Herzegovina were worried that it will make it difficult for them to trade with Croatia for very obvious reasons, that European accessing European Union market, it's notoriously bureaucratic, all kinds of standards, rights that you have to meet. So while accession of Croatia was viewed as something that Croatia wanted, and in many corners it was viewed as progressive, it was done at the expense of the immediate regional tie with their neighbors. So that's a very good example, as well as Kosovo, Mitrovica region, right? This is a good case, Croatia in particular, a good case to demonstrate the value of immediate regional connections between states and communities. And very often the leaders of the states themselves will chase for this bigger regional shinier projects, but those big shiny regional mega projects, they are favorable. They work for large businesses who can access these distant markets. Less of an issue for Croatia. But for, in the case of Georgia, for smaller entrepreneurs, they do need their neighbor across the border. So these regional connections are much more local, and developmental impact of this immediate regional connections is enormous in some of these conflict regions. In regards to, I'm not sure if I understood your question on the Caucasus. Can you?
Actually, it's just not the region question on the Caucasus, but I'm thinking that unless we heal the smaller fractures,
that's right.
Would we go about healing the bigger fractures?
That's right. Smaller fractures. I love it. And it does start from the smaller fractures, addressing the smaller fractures. When I mentioned earlier that there is a need to create some sort of a regional order from which big peace bargains, peace agreements can follow, that's exactly what I meant. And you're actually putting in much better terms than I did, that creating such opportunities at the local level, grassroots community, it will create the peace dividend in order to prepare the public for compromises needed for the big peace agreements. And there are a lot of policy discussion as to how to orchestrate and build this kinds of connections. Very often politicians within capitals will obstruct. Communities do want to engage across conflict lines. It's the politicians that will prevent them. And I don't want to name names, but there are a lot of cases that I've come across. Which the policy implication from your question is, what can the mediators ask for? Mediators, negotiators that are meeting with the elites, what can they ask first? Who they can ask to be at the table in terms of sequencing, which policies should go first. And the everyday life fractures need to be addressed before any big bargains can be entertained. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions maybe. All right, so why don't we take together and then we'll have Anna sort of sum up, but in the back and then in the front.
Hi, thank you very much. James Siebens from the Stimson Center. I wonder to what extent you think that a project like the Eurasian Union might actually generate an opportunity for smaller states to bargain collectively and to sort of balance with Russia.
Great. Actually, collective bargaining is an important keyword in your question, and that's exactly what has escaped many politicians in the smaller states. The regional fracture, the implications from the regional fracture theory rest essentially, it's a call for peripheral states to coalesce, take ownership over their regions. Right now, all of the states are pulled into an imperial game by the Kremlin. And again, Kremlin is not, Russia is not the only country that has, only hegemon that practices this. I don't want to argue that Russia is the only one that does this. All formerly, former empires that continue such policies there. But in the case of Russia, it's interesting that there has been such a drive by these new post-Soviet states to integrate with a particular regional project, that insecurities are there, that there is very little push in coalescing, in coordinating. That's the only way to moderate Russia's behavior in those spaces. That's the only way to maintain transparency over Russia's involvement in those spaces. As for Eurasian Economic Union, it's a large market. It's close to China. It has all of the economic ingredients that it can do well. But as it is also evident in the empirical chapters, Eurasian Economic Union does remain a geopolitical Russia-driven project. And it's a lesson that the United States also has been. There's a lot of scholarship, John Eikenberry, et cetera, that are arguing that hegemons succeed in sustaining their power if they follow their own rules that they create. In the case of Russia, that has not always been the case. So the message to Russia would be to learn to become a genuine regional player. That might mean giving up some power to the institutions that it created, right? And for the states to really coordinate, even if, for example, Armenia is part of Eurasian Economic Union, Georgia is not. Even here, they have to coordinate actions in order to benefit from Russia's economic opportunities.
If I could just jump in here, I think one of the interesting questions with some of the peripheral states in the Eurasian Economic Union is to what extent they'll coordinate among themselves rather, you know, on a multilateral level rather than similar Russian-backed projects represent. I just got back from Central Asia, actually, and one of the really interesting things that people are talking about there right now is to what extent it's possible to think about some kind of regional mechanisms that's owned by the Central Asian countries themselves, that's not, you know, part of a Russian or Chinese-backed geopolitical project. Now, of course, there's a long way to go for this to happen. There's a lot of mistrust and a lot of historical legacies that make that kind of regional integration or, let's not even use the word integration, regional engagement or cooperation possible, but there's at least more receptiveness to talking about it now than I think there's been in a long time. Okay, I think we need to wrap up, so let's take one final question and then we'll go.
Hi, thanks. My name is Jack Kropansky, unaffiliated. Two traditional phrases I didn't hear you use were the near abroad and spheres of influence. And I was just thinking. I didn't hear you use them, so just curious what you think about them, whether they matter anymore, comparing Ukraine and Syria being kind of near and Venezuela and Cuba being far. I mean, how are those two pairs different other than this sphere of influence kind of concept?
It's interesting you ask that question. The title of the book is Russia Abroad, which I wish I could take credit for the book title. My editor actually chose that title. My title was Lenin's Revenge, Driving Green, da-da-da. his approach was Russia Abroad. And the reason that I liked Russia Abroad is that it's a play on near abroad. Essentially, we're trying to say with this book that sphere of privileged interest near abroad is not, it should not be viewed by Russian government or countries in these peripheries as privileged, as the entitlement for Russia. That something is happening in these peripheries that prevent full, total control over this periphery is number one. And number two, but we're not saying that spheres of influence will be erased from exercise of regional world politics, absolutely not. But we do say that the fractured nature of these regions undermines the statecraft of these states. only if the stronger state will be able to check and control spheres of external intruders into their region. And countries on their own will not be able to do that bilaterally. They need to be stronger regional forums to do that. And countries, I mean, Russia will continue and continues to obviously to engage in Venezuela, try to influence the politics there. But the fractured state and statehood in fractured regions makes it difficult for the smaller states to check this really big mega regional projects and big hegemonic players.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
That's a good place to end on. This has been a really wide-ranging discussion. I think we covered a lot, both geographically and substantively. I hope you've all found it useful, and please join me in thanking our speaker. Thank you.